So wish everyone good evening. I don't usually say classes to ladies only, but in this case there was an exception that I have my wife with me. So I think we have some very important lessons to learn from the parashiyot of these weeks. And for people who, as I understand, within the community, but those who are looking for improvement, for change, for developing the level of the keeping Torah and understanding Torah, so maybe the things are a little bit profound, a bit deep, but I think they're very important lessons. We find in this week's parasha Yaakov coming back after so many years, coming back home, and he sends a present to his brother Esav to appease him from his anger, and he sends him a very lavish gift, and it says Leman imsahen be'enei Adoni, in order that I should find favor in your eyes. And that sounds a bit strange. That's going to just annoy him and awaken his jealousy. Esav understood that they made a deal. He made a deal with Yaakov. He gave up his birthright, which really, it was his zechut that he would be the Bechor, firstborn. So he would have a spiritual life. And he sold that for a plate full of lentil soup. And he chose the material life. He chose this world. He forfeited his merit to the world to come and chose this world. All of a sudden, he sees Yaakov coming back, a millionaire, and sending him a lavish gift. And for sure he's going to think, you know, that's not fair. We made a deal. You took the spiritual life and you left for me the material life. You left for me this world. All of a sudden I see you enjoying the best of both worlds. You have the spiritual world as well as the material world. So how is that going to appease Esav? It's going to just awaken his anger more and more. However, we see what took place, what transpired. At a time of war, danger, Esav had 400 mercenary soldiers all ready to fight Yaakov, and Yaakov fears what's going to be. He prepares himself for praying, for a present, for even a fight. He divides up his family into three groups, hoping that if Esav attacks this one, the others will escape. And all of a sudden he remembers that he left behind at the last place where they camped some, I could say, pachim ktanim. Our rabbis tell us pachim ktanim, small vessels. You could imagine some empty beer bottles or Coca-Cola bottles. That's what it means. Ve'avor ma'avar yabok, he went back, he crossed the river. He left his family. And he goes back and crosses the river and goes looking for those empty bottles. And he meets up with the angel of Esav and they fight till morning. So all this has to be understood. What happened here? What transpired here? And it says the angel saw he couldn't overcome Yaakov. Vayar ki lo yachol lo. In other words, really, Yaakov stood his own. So what were they fighting about? And why did Yaakov go back for these pachim ktanim, empty, you know, waste bottles, empty bottles? So we can understand this to mean that it's true, Yaakov took, when he traded in with Esav, spirituality against the material life, it didn't mean that Yaakov doesn't have any connection with the material world. as we know, in kemach, in Torah, without a base in the material world, you can't build the spiritual world. Everything depends on having some sort of material existence. However, the Jewish concept of materialism, of wealth, is not as an end in itself. We don't see it as an end in itself. We don't see success, financial success, to mean that you can, you have the capabilities to afford, to enjoy, and to indulge, and to just fill all your lusts and desires. We see it as a possibility of using the bracha of Hashem that Hashem has given us in the material world for our spiritual lives. So really, when Esav thinks to himself, my brother Yaakov has taken the best of both worlds, he has the material world as well, Yaakov's answer would be, whatever you see, all my wealth is to be used for Torah, mitzvot, u'ma'asim tovim. It's to be used for spirituality. Bechol derachecha da'ehu. The Torah teaches us that to connect up with Hashem, to serve Hashem, to do His will, is not only in what we would expect to be the four cubits of praying and tefillin and tzitzit and the synagogue and the yeshiva. Serving Hashem is everywhere and in everything. So when Hashem has blessed us with material means, we use it for spirituality. We transcend it to a high level and use it for Torah, mitzvot, ma'asim tovim. We can send our children to the better schools and pay whatever we have to the tuition. We can buy the best of the mitzvot, whether it's in Sukkot to buy the Arba Minim or to buy beautiful tefillin and tzitzit and to make our home, our Shabbat table beautiful and delicious and in every way to give honor to the keeping of Torah mitzvot. So we use whatever we have, material capabilities, for our spiritual life. Okay, that sounds nice, it sounds convincing, but maybe Esav thought, you know, you're kidding yourself. If you're rich, you're going to indulge. If you're rich, you're going to relate to your wealth as an end in itself. And Esav, for sure, by him, anything material was just that, no more, physical. When he sold the birthright to Yaakov, his argument was, I'm going to die, so what do I need the birthright for? What did he mean? He saw himself as a chunk of meat living. So when he dies, he sees himself like a carcass, nothing. He doesn't believe in a soul. He doesn't believe that there is such a concept as a Jewish soul. So for him, of course, everything material was just that, nothing beyond that. Whereas Yaakov was relating to whatever he had, the Birchat Hashem, what Hashem blessed him with, as an opening for serving Hashem and lifting up and transforming the material to the spiritual. So how it sounds very nice, but how did Yaakov prove his argument? So we find that he went back for these pachim ktanim, for these little vessels. If a person relates to empty vessels just as their material value, they're worthless. And it would certainly not justify going all the way back and crossing over the river and at the time of danger, a time of war. When you're so worried about what's going to be with your family, you leave them and you go back for pachim ktanim. It doesn't make sense. So we learn out that Hazal tell us here something very deep, that Yaakov did not relate to these empty vessels as their material value. He related them as their spiritual value. So we ask, what spiritual value do they have? We have a saying, our rabbi said, Tzadikim haviv lahem mamunam yoter megufam. It's very strange. The righteous, they respect, they regard their money more than their bodies. doesn't make sense. A righteous person thinks about his money, respects his money. What does it mean? So the Arizal explains, everything that we own, everything that we possess in this world, in the physical world, our very existence in the physical world comes down to us from the higher spiritual worlds. The Nefesh HaHayim, who is the Talmid of the Vilna Gaon, his name was Reb Chaim Mevilojin, Reb Chaim from Vilojin. He writes that a person is really rooted in the spiritual worlds. From there, he comes down level after level till he exists in a physical world as well. But his neshama is always rooted up in the higher worlds. And this, in fact, was the dream of Yaakov. He saw a ladder transcending all the way up to the heavens, but the feet of the ladder were in this world, but the ladder was going up into the higher worlds, all the way up. As it says, Sulam Mutzab Arza Veroshu Magia Shamaima. So what is this ladder? This ladder is the human being, meaning a human being, he exists in this world, that's the physical side of him. But his soul is within him, part of his soul, but the higher levels of his soul exist in a much more spiritual existence and transcend to the highest of worlds, till he is really connected up at the source of his soul with Hashem. That's why a Jewish person, continuously through his prayers, through his study of Torah, through his keeping of mitzvot, he connects up with the spiritual worlds. And this gives him the capability of transforming everything spiritual, everything physical, and making it spiritual. And we find so many halachot, for example, the mitzvah of Onik Shabbat, to be happy on Shabbat, to enjoy Shabbat. And the very expression of having neshama yetera on Shabbat, as we know, we have an extra soul, an extra neshama on Shabbat. Rashi explained, how is it felt? How do we sense and feel the extra soul that we have? He says, by eating more. That makes sense. The soul eats, and by eating we're going to feel the soul. Because our eating on Shabbat is on a different plane altogether. It's spiritual. You're doing a mitzvah. When you have onik Shabbat, when you enjoy Shabbat, you have pleasure on Shabbat, you're doing it lichbod Shabbat, in the honor of Shabbat, you're lifting up that very act of eating which even an animal eats. So it's just a physical function that any living thing does, and yet we can make it transcend it to a much higher spiritual level, and it becomes Avodat Hashem. And the very enjoying of Shabbat is expressed, the neshama yetera is felt by the extra appetite that a person has on Shabbat. So we see from here that how do we have this power? How do we have this capability of transforming the physical to the spiritual? That comes from the fact that we are partly physical, but we are also spiritual. And by our soul being connected up into the higher worlds, everything that comes, that we can come in contact with, we can transform it by using it for a mitzvah and uplifting it from the material existence to a much more spiritual existence and transcend it to the highest of heights. So the Arizal explains why the Sadiqim regard and respect their material wealth more than their bodies, more than their physical comfort, let's say. The reason being is they don't look at something physical as what it is, just something physical, and that's it. They see its spiritual potential and its spiritual source. Where did it come from? So if we understand that a penny I have in my pocket comes from the beracha of Hashem, which was given to me at a much higher spiritual level, and that comes down from level to level, from world to world, from level to level, till it becomes a penny in my pocket. So when I relate to that penny, I'm not relating to it as its physical existence now, but I relate to it as what it is, in fact, in the source of my soul, something spiritual, a spiritual light in my soul. So it has tremendous value. So Yaakov Avinu went back for Pachim Ktanim, because he didn't look at them as just empty beer bottles. He looked at them as a light in the source of his soul. we'll explain this concept more, and I hope it will be more tangible, more understood. The point I want to make is that we see here, we understand from here, that this is the essence of a Jew's life. And this is what Yaakov and Esav were fighting about when they were even in pregnancy. As it says, Vayitrosasu habanim bikirba, Rashi explains that what seemed to be like two twins in their mother's stomach fighting was really, they were fighting about this world and the world to come, about spirituality and about the material world. And this fight remains. It remains till this very day. And this is, maybe we could say, the source of anti-Semitism, for example. When the Goyim see Jews indulging in physical wealth, in material wealth, as an end in itself, like the Goyim see it, wealth is there to be enjoyed. And they don't, and not to be used for spiritual serving of Hashem. But when we do use our physical blessing, our material blessing, for serving Hashem, they will not hate us for that, because they see it transcending to a spiritual level. So this is something which very, very, very much appertains to our lives. But we have to understand the whole Jewish way of life, the whole mode of Jewish life is based on this concept of relating to things not at the mere physical value or their physical existence, but to how we can use them and transcend them to a spiritual level. This we can see, for example, that this is the very essence of the Jewish religion. How can we see it? The Gemara in Avodah Zarah says that in the world to come, Hashem takes a Sefer Torah in his arms and says, whoever kept Torah should come and receive his reward. And all the Goyim clamor in and come and say, we want reward. Hashem said, you learned Torah, you kept Torah. They said, no, but we built roads, we built bridges, we built buildings, we invented all sorts of inventions, telephones, cellular phones, fax machines, high-tech, everything. And the Jewish people use all these things to learn Torah. So we deserve a reward. Through us, they learn Torah. So Hashem says, okay, we'll test you on that. And Hashem said, I have a little mitzvah in my treasure house, which I'm going to try you. See how you will relate to this mitzvah. And it's called Sukkah. Make this mitzvah of Sukkah. So all the Goyim went and made Sukkot. And then Hashem made it very hot. The sun was burning down on them. And they felt, of course, very uncomfortable. They couldn't stand it in the Sukkot. So they all got out of their Sukkot and kicked them down and left. So Hashem said, now, you see, you don't deserve any reward. So we have to understand this. Why did Hashem test them with the Sukkah? Why didn't he test them with something else? The answer is that there's something very special in the mitzvah of Sukkah. First of all, in that very Gemara, Hashem said, I have a small mitzvah in my treasure house. I'm going to try you with that. Why did he call Sukkah a small mitzvah? So Rashi explains, because it doesn't cost anything to make a Sukkah. You need a few planks, a few pieces of wood, some branches, leaves, twigs, and you have a Sukkah. It doesn't cost money. In fact, the wording of Hazal in the Gemara is, Pisolet Goren Veyekim. The waste of the granaries, the waste of the threshing houses, of the wine press and of the olive press. That means after you've gathered in your harvest, you've taken all what's edible, what's food, the grain, the fruits, the vegetables, you've put them in your storehouses, and what's left, the twigs, the leaves, the stalks, all the waste, you throw away. Pesolet Goren Veyekem. That's called Pesolet Goren Veyekem. That's the waste. Now you can take this waste and you make it into a Sukkah. And that's a Sukkah. But when a Jewish person looks at a Sukkah, what does he see? He enters a sukkah like going into a synagogue, even like a Beit Mikdash. Hazal tell us, and it says in the Zohar, that the sukkah is, when you're sitting in a sukkah, you're bitzila de mehemnuta. You're as if in the shade, the shadow of the divine presence of the Shekhinah. We know the sukkah is so holy. The ushpizin are there. Abraham, Isaac, Yaakov, Moshe, Aharon, David, Yosef with David. They're all there. Our custom is we put a chair in the corner of the sukkah. And every night we invite the Ushpiza, the special guest. We say it's the first night, we say it's Avraham Avinu. The next night is Yitzhak. The third night is Yaakov. The fourth night is Moshe. The fifth night is Aharon. Then Yosef. Then David. And we say every night we invite all the seven guests. But the main guest is the one, you know, in that order. Avraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, etc. When we relate to a sukkah, we see it as the most holy of holies. There are halachot in a sukkah. For example, you're not supposed to bring heavy pans or sirim, how you say, dish, cooking pots into the sukkah. Unless it's something you bring on your table as well in your home. But in those days, in the old days, the cooking pots were very blackened and very unattractive. No one would ever bring them as a serving vessel on the table, so you can't take them into a sukkah. There are laws in a sukkah. There are many laws. Besides that, Hazal tell us Shem Shamayim Halal Aschach. You take these leaves, these twigs, these branches. Even when you dismantle the sukkah, you're not supposed to trouble them anymore. The name of Hashem has come onto the sukkah. It's become something spiritual. When we look at sukkah, we don't look at it just as a few twigs and sticks and leaves. We look at it as something spiritual. It's no less spiritual than a Sefer Torah or a tefillin. It's a holy mitzvah. In fact, the very gematria, the numerical value of sukkah, is the two names of Hashem, Havaya Adanut. Yod Ke Vav Ke is 26. Adanut, Aleph Dalet Nun Yod, is 65. So that sukkah is 26 and 65. To teach us that the name of Hashem is on a sukkah. So when we look at a sukkah, we don't look at it as just something trivial. We look at it as something holy. Now the halakha is that if you're uncomfortable in the sukkah, for example, if it's very hot, and if you go into your home, you'll feel comfortable, you're allowed to leave the sukkah. You're patur. You're exempt. If the mosquito is troubling you, and if you go in, you won't be bothered by them, you can go in. Patur, hamitztaer patur min ha-sukkah is a halakha. If you're suffering in the sukkah, you can leave and go in your house. As long as you'll have comfort in your house. So the goyim left the sukkah. What's the big deal? It's hot. And they're exempt. So they left. The question is, why did they kick it down? They kicked it down. The answer is, goyim cannot relate to something physical and see its spiritual value. That's their problem. They don't see it as something spiritual. They don't see the Shem Shamayim, which is on the Schach. They don't see the Shekhinah. They don't see Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. They don't see them. They don't link up to the spiritual concept. For them, it's just a few planks and twigs and leaves. It's hot, kick it down. That's it. That's why Hashem chose to test them on this point, on the sukkah. Why? Because what was their claim? Their claim was, we invented all sorts of things, and through our inventions, the Jewish people could keep mitzvot and could learn Torah. So we deserve reward. They changed the raw material which we invented and created and made it into spirituality. So Hashem says, yes, but don't you see, you have no such claim. Because you disagree with that very concept of changing the physical into the spiritual. You kick down a sukkah. That means you relate to a sukkah as no more than a few planks and twigs and leaves and branches. You don't see it as something spiritual. So if you don't recognize that possibility of the physical and the material transcending to a spiritual level, you cannot make such a claim and say, look, we invented things and the Jews made them into spirituality. Yeah, the Jews can do that, but you have no claim on that, because you don't even agree with that concept, you don't even accept that concept, you cannot even comprehend that concept. So there's no way that you can get reward. That's why Hashem chose that particular mitzvah of Sukkah to test them. We see the same point, we're very near now to Hanukkah, we see the same point throughout the whole battle with the Greeks. Anyone who understands the difference between Hanukkah and Purim, Haman did not differentiate between types of Jews, or he was not involved in any, he didn't want to change the Jewish people, he just wanted to annihilate them, to destroy them, to kill them. Anashim, Nashim, Vitaf, men, women and children. But the Greeks, that was not their agenda, they wanted to assimilate the Jewish people. They wanted the Jewish people to give up their customs and accept the Roman way of life. And what was the Roman way of life? It was completely opposed to the Jewish way of life. We see all the gzerot that they made, all the enactments, how we say, the gzerot, all the decrees that they made seem to have just one common denominator: to uproot the concept of spirituality from the Jewish home. That's what it was all about. We see, for example, they forbade Shabbat. Why? Shabbat, Hagim and Rosh Chodesh. They say, Ma Yom Yomayim. What's the difference between one day and another? All days are the same. We have a 7-day week. There's no such thing. Is there anything different? Does the sun come up later, set earlier? Is it different physically? It's not. If it's not different physically, it's the same. All days are the same. The fact that we believe that Shabbat is a holy day, and that the holiday is a holy day, and Rosh Chodesh is a holy day, they can't accept that. That's not tangible. That's something physical. That's something spiritual. They cannot even appreciate or understand. So you have to uproot it. This crazy Jewish trend of relating to spiritual things which don't exist, you have to uproot. So all the gzerot, the gzera against the mitzvah of Brit Milah, what was their point? Very simple. Just like you can't say one day is different from another, you can't say one human being is different from another. There is no such thing. The Jewish people believe that by Brit Milah, a person is uplifted to a higher spiritual plane. They can't accept that. There's no way. So they make a decree against Brit Milah. You're not allowed to do Brit Milah. Or for example, the very concept of marriage by Goyim is just indulging in physical pleasure. By Am Yisrael, it's a different concept altogether. It's to build a Jewish home and have children and educate them in Torah and keep mitzvot and to come to completion. That a person is not complete as long as he's single. He only attains completion when he marries. And that means completion, spiritual completion, in the keeping of Torah and mitzvot. It's a different level altogether. As Hazal say, Asharui belo isha, Asharui belo choma, belo tova, ubelo simha, ubelo Torah. Someone who is still single, does not have any protection, does not have any happiness, does not have even Torah. So a person becomes spiritually complete by getting married. That concept of marriage cannot be accepted by them. And they wanted to contaminate the very concept of a holy marriage by making every Jewish kala first have relations with the Roman general to try and uproot the Kiddushah from Am Yisrael. And that was all the gzerot. A Jewish person goes to work. So a Roman goes to work. He says, you have to work hard, you have to sweat, you have to be clever, and you'll be successful. You'll make money. A Jewish person goes to work. He thinks the bracha is from Hashem. I'm only doing hishtadlut. I'm just making my effort, but the bracha has to come from Hashem. It's all from Hashem anyway. It's not important whether I'm brilliant, whether I'm not brilliant, whether I have good connections, no good. Hashem can give me. I trust in Hashem. So let's say a Jewish person is going to work and he's drawing he's got a cow or a bull a buffalo drawing his cart, and he's taking his wares to the market to sell. And he's thinking to himself, Hashem runs the world, everything is Hashgaha, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he is the one who gives Parnasa, I trust in him, I believe in him, he's going to give me Beracha. So what did the Romans say? You have to tie between the horns of the buffalo a sticker saying, Ein li helek be'elokei Israel, I don't believe in the Jewish God. In other words, I oppose this concept, the Jewish concept of God being involved in everything. There's no way. They don't want... HaKadosh Baruch Hu is too big to be involved in mundane matters. He doesn't decide if you're going to make a dollar or not going to make a dollar. That's not for Hashem to do. But we know it is like that. That everything is spiritual. We see things as something spiritual, not as something physical. So we see how the Greeks were out to uproot this concept of spirituality from Am Yisrael. This they couldn't take. They couldn't accept in any way. The same thing we see, a very strange thing. They fought a very hard battle. It went on for years. Till finally they breached the walls, they went into Yerushalayim, they come into the Beit HaMikdash, and there's treasure houses of gold and silver, millions and millions of dollars worth of precious stones and wealth. All of a sudden, what do they do? They lose interest in the or everything precious, and they go looking around for the pure olive oil, and they want to contaminate every single bottle of pure olive oil. V'timu et kol hashemanim, as we say in the prayer. V'timu et kol hashemanim. They made impure all the oils. Isn't it crazy? What's the big issue in the oil? But they know what that signifies. Our rabbis tell us, every single day there was a miracle in the Beit HaMikdash. That means that the Kohen would put the same amount of oil in all the seven branches. And at the end of the day, they were all extinguished except the middle one. And every day was that miracle that the seventh one was never ever extinguished. What did that signify? Chachamim tell us, Shashchina Shura b'Yisrael, the divine presence exists with the Jewish people. The Shechina, the divine presence is with us. So this concept of spirituality, the Goyim have to uproot, they have to destroy. That's why they went after the oil. It meant so much to them. We know the menorah itself they took back to Rome. It's one of their prize trophies to keep. They have it till this very day in Rome. Took it with them. Why? Because this concept of light, this concept of spirituality, they cannot accept and they have to fight against. This is their whole way of life. And this goes back all the way. We find, for example, Abraham taking Yitzhak to offer him up. And then he says, he looks from afar and he sees a cloud. He sees something spiritual on the mountain. Then he knew that's where he has to offer up his son. What did he see? He saw the Shekhinah. He saw the divine presence. So he knew that was the place. And when he asked Eliezer and the other young men who were accompanying them, do you see anything? They said, yeah, we see a cloud. So he says, sit here, remain here. Ama domei lahamor. You're like donkeys. You don't see the spirituality. You don't realize you're looking at the Shekhinah. You're seeing a cloud. One rabbi used to say, when any human being stands in front of a donkey, he's thinking to himself, this guy is going to sit on me, and he's thinking how heavy, how fat he is, how heavy he's going to be, how am I going to handle him. So if he has a stallion standing in front of him, or the Hafez Haim Lehabdil standing, doesn't mean, it's just a chunk of meat for him. A donkey just sees a human being as a chunk of meat, and how heavy he's going to be when he's going to sit on him. That's all. So that's the wrong way of looking at things. That's the donkey's way. It's not our way of looking at things. We look at things when people look at a great rabbi, they see something spiritual. They don't look at him just as a something physical, just as a physical, something physical. They see the spirituality. They relate to anything physical in accordance with its spiritual value. This is the Jewish way of looking at things. And this is what makes us special among all the people of the world. And this is what makes our way of life so special. However, we have to be able to translate this message into our everyday lives. We're living in a very, very material world, a very, very physical world. Mainly, we could say that we're very much brainwashed. Our way of thinking, our way of relating to almost everything is a very non-Jewish way, a very improper way, a very wrong way. It's not the way of the Torah. Even maybe the very concept of what beauty is. It can't be that Hollywood or Paris are going to decide for us what beauty means. It can't be that some pervert people who are completely immersed in the most wicked things and are pervert and crooked in their minds, that these people are going to be, for example, the designers of clothes and are going to decide what is attractive and what is not attractive. And the whole world goes after them, completely brainwashed, and no one ever questions. You cannot, it's like questioning, Hasv Shalom, the words of the Torah. You can't, they decided already in Paris, this year, this is how it has to be. Everything else you have to dump in the guy. It's worthless anymore. It's not the fashion. The fashion has to be, it has to be this. I mean, we can speak about, say, men's fashion. So one year they decide that this year the ties have to be broad and the belts have to be narrow. And the shoes have to be pointed. So that's it. The next year the ties will be slim and the belts thick and the shoes round. So some crazy people make these decisions and the whole world is running after these decisions as if they heard a divine pronouncement of what should be and what shouldn't be. It's a joke. But if we think about it, it's a very serious joke. It's something very serious that most people live their lives completely influenced by and completely brainwashed by the non-Jewish concepts of living a life. Where everything is decided upon and relates to most probably some form of evil. For sure, immorality, maybe much, much worse. Today it could even be a lot of idolatry. People don't realize how many of the way the goyim think and behave and do and what they do. Many of these mannerisms and these customs and these ways stem from occult practices of their idolatrous religions. For example, even you could say in non-conventional medicines that people try today, like energy and other things, all these practices have sources in the Eastern religions and stem from practices of idol worship and are very wrong according to the Torah concept. They may look innocent, they may sound innocent, people are trying to camouflage them and to maybe convince people that it's nothing to do with anything. It's very simple concepts and maybe even Jewish concepts. They try and camouflage these things. But the truth is, these things are stemming from the goyim. We have a very important rule. It's called Koh HaPoel BeNif'al. What does that mean? Koh HaPoel BeNif'al. For example, I'll give you an example. The force of the doer is in the done. That's what it literally means. What could it mean? You could have a humash, the same humash, printed by yeshiva in Yerushalayim. Or you could have the same humash printed by the missionaries. nothing, they didn't change anything. Let's assume they didn't change anything. This is Kadosh and this is Tameh. You have to, the missionaries, Humash, the same. With the names of God and everything, it has to be maybe burnt or buried, whatever. It can't be used. There's a certain group who very much misuse in our generation the wisdom, the secret wisdom of the Kabbalah, and they make it something for Hollywood, something for Goyim, and they throw it around on the street corners, and some of the books they print are exactly word by word. They print the Zohar word by word as anyone else prints the Zohar. It has to be put in a Ginizah. It cannot be used. Some say it has to be burnt, because evil people are doing this. So in other words, it's not just, there is such a thing that that something which comes to be is created by someone who is evil, it has in it evil. Something that comes to be by someone who is holy and good, that thing is going to be holy and good. For example, people could ask, okay, pop music, jazz, you're not supposed to listen, maybe, because it's not Jewish. But classical music, what's wrong in classical music? It's just some sort of a nice tune and a very, you know, big orchestra playing lovely music, you know, nice instruments, and that's it. There's no words to it, there's no singing, nothing. The truth is, that's also a problem. These composers, whether it's Beethoven or Tchaikovsky, whoever they are, they created this music or as church music in the honor of their beliefs and their gods, or quite often with very immoral themes and thoughts in their minds. I mean, music is meant to make you happy, to make you sad, to awaken with the new emotions. And the person who composed that music, he is really having an influence on how you feel and how you think. And if he draws his inspiration from a source which is impure, through his music he's putting in his impurity into you. Just like anyone would understand that, for example, we have a story in the Gemara. One of the rabbis was unbelievable in answering questions. Any question he was asked, he could answer. So once they asked him, tell me, where did you get this brilliance from that you can answer all these questions on the spot, you know everything? He said, when I was very young, I didn't see Rabbi Meir, but I saw his walking stick. Just to see the walking stick of the rabbi already had a good influence on me. Coming into contact with anything spiritual or holy has a good influence. Coming into contact with something which is secular, which is evil, it's going to have a bad influence. I know I'm speaking things maybe a bit frightening, certainly not things that it's on a daily, you would expect, you know, maybe you don't hear it very often, but it's the most important concept of the Torah, which is the holiness of Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael was chosen to be a holy nation. And the holiest part of Klal Yisrael are the women of Klal Yisrael. Because the women of Klal Yisrael are those who are guaranteeing what a Jewish home is and what the future Jewish people, which are the Jewish children, are going to be. And the influence of a mother on a child is much more even than of a father on his child. One of the great Hachamim, he was once asked, who was your rabbi? He said, my mother. She was my rabbi. Everything I learned from my mother. Whatever I know about Judaism, I know from my mother. The influence of a mother on a child is unbelievable. We know, for example, it's a fact. For example, it says so in the Gemara, but it's also, you know, it's a well-known fact. In the Gemara, it's to tell the story of, let's say, a couple who had in their bedroom, say, a statue of a Negro. And they had children who were black. These type of things have an influence. Rabbi Yohanan, one of the greatest Hachamim, who was, by the way, very, very, I don't know the right word, to say handsome or outstandingly beautiful as a human being. So much so that Resh Lakish, who was one of the big bandits of the time, the head of the mafia, saw him swimming and thought that he was a lady, and he jumped into the water, and then he saw it was a rabbi, and the rabbi said to him, look, if you come and learn Torah, I'll give you my sister, she's even more beautiful than me. And he became the famous Resh Lakish, the great Hacham Resh Lakish. So we hear about Rabbi Yohanan, what he used to do. He used to go and sit opposite the door of the mikveh where the women would come out of the tevilah. And he would say, if they would look on me, they're going to have children with a holy countenance. They're going to have holy children. So the first thing women should see would be something holy. By the way, there is a halakha that a woman who comes out of a mikveh should not, the first thing she should make sure not to look at something which is impure, like say a dog or something like that. She must try to, that these things have an influence. It's a halakha. So we see from all this how susceptible we are to be influenced. I mean, this relates to our children, this relates to our husbands, this relates to ourselves, this relates to the type of magazines we're going to look at, more so to maybe what type of things we read, which really people who are born and bred and live off the whole non-Jewish concept of what marriage and romance and love and all these things are and what they expect from life is a completely wrong concept. It's not the Jewish concept, it's not the way we look at it. It's not that we don't have the concept, of course, there must exist love between a couple, there must be feeling in a marriage, there must be pleasure and enjoyment in a marriage, but it must be the Jewish way. There's a holy way, a Jewish way, the proper way. But people who are already bred and brainwashed into expecting what the goyim see as what they expect to see in a relationship of a man and wife. So for sure, these people are going to be all their lives frustrated that maybe they're not getting what they want because they're expecting something which is not part of what the Jewish religion is. So if we look at all this, we can see how dangerous it is to be exposed to this type of the evil of the outside world. I'm bringing many proofs. I've already said some. I'll bring more. It says, one of the daughter-in-laws of Shammai, the great Rosh Hashiva, the one who used to argue with Hillel and discuss with Hillel, one of his daughter-in-laws used to bring a baby's crib into the yeshiva, and she would say, I want my child to absorb Torah right from the inset of his life, from the beginning, that the Torah should enter him and sanctify and make him holy. So what is this concept? A baby doesn't understand. For him it's just voices in the background that has an influence. Depends what the voices are. Some homes have the radio on and you hear all sorts of nonsense, all sorts of garbage. Who knows this poor baby what he's getting into his mind? Then we want the baby to go to a good yeshiva and learn and become a Talmid Chacham. What's going to be? It's already, we're harming them. It's like germs, bacteria, bar minan. We have to understand that everything has an influence. Nothing is just by the way. Everything we see, everything we hear, everything we read is making an impression on us for good or for bad. If we come in contact with holy things and good things, it has a good influence. It purifies us, it uplifts us. If we come in contact with bad things, it's going to contaminate us. Koach ha-poel benif'al. For example, the Pele Yoetz writes that he knows people who did a lot to try and encourage their children to learn and to become hachamim. They would hire rabbis to learn with them and pay any amount of money so that their children will be in the best yeshivot and have the best rabbis to teach them, that they're going to become big hachamim. But they were not successful. So Pele Yoetz says, look back and find out how these people are earning their living. Are they honest in their business? If they're dishonest in their business, that money which is impure has a bad influence and it cannot develop the Torah of their children. It's not pure money. Pure money, for example, people who know the value of spirituality would be very particular not to take even contributions for yeshivas if the money is coming from an improper source. Some people, for example, earn their money in very immoral ways, or in very crooked ways. That type of money would harm Torah. If you would donate such money to a yeshiva, the Torah learned in that yeshiva is not going to be pure Torah. It's going to be warped. It's going to develop people who have warped minds, and not, they won't be holy people. That money has an effect. And so it is with everything. Hazal tell us to eat food which is not kosher. It causes your mind to become warped. Everything has an influence on us. And this is the whole concept of Yaakov and Esav. This is the whole concept of Judaism. This is the whole fight, the battle that exists between the Romans and the Jewish people. Our way of life is Kiddusha. Our way of life is holiness. Our way of life is spirituality. It's to relate to things in a spiritual way. Not to be influenced by the world outside. Not to accept their explanations and their understanding, which is completely warped and comes only from their desire for lust and pleasure, and that's all. Everything is just material and physical with no other motive behind it. Whereas by us, everything is seen in a different way. So all the concepts of Judaism are going to be different. They're going to be spiritual concepts. You're going to see things in a spiritual way. We have to tune in to seeing things in a spiritual way. It's a difficult thing. I know it's not an easy level to be at, especially when you're surrounded completely. We're absolutely surrounded. We're immersed in the non-Jewish way of life, in the non-Jewish way of thinking. And we're surrounded. You cannot, wherever you go, wherever you are, everything is like that. You drive, you see posters. It's a whole. What can I say? A huge world war against the Jewish way of thinking. Every single poster is selling something where the concept of that sale is most probably evil. Even if they're selling a watch or a car, they can't sell a watch or a car without relating it to some other things. It has to have a very beautiful girl in it or something like that. Everything has to be linked up with the immoral, with the improper, with the wrong. And of course, we cannot be naive and think, you know, we see these things and it doesn't affect us. It affects us. It has a very damaging, makes a very damaging impression on us. And more so to women. As we said before, we brought quite a few proofs to this, that if we understand what a Jewish wife is, that literally she is the factory within which the future of Klal Yisrael is being prepared. The babies are born within a mother. So the mother has to be really on a very high level. Some, for example, go to the extent to say that that since certain things cause lack of memory, so they say a pregnant woman maybe shouldn't eat these things. So maybe she's going to have a baby boy. She doesn't want her boy from the beginning of being conceived to have any connection with something which is going to make him finally, when he's born, to be a forgetter of Torah. He'll have a good memory to learn Torah. For example, to what extent do we go to relate to these influences? And the spiritual influences are even more than this type of influence of what's going to cause you to forget, etc. The spiritual influences, like we said before, this daughter of Beit Shammai, who knew how to bring her little kid into the yeshiva, that her child would hear the words of Torah from its inset. He doesn't even know what they're talking about. The words of Torah are purifying. The words of Torah are uplifting. They're putting Kiddusha into this boy, this baby. When he grows up, he'll become a Tamid Hakam. He'll be holy. It'll be a different kid. So maybe we don't have that possibility. Not every lady can take her baby's crib and put it in the yeshiva. Maybe the yeshiva will say, look, take it away. Okay, we understand that, but at least to protect our homes, at least our homes, the least we can expect from ourselves is that our homes should be holy places. That means if we cannot control the world outside of it, We have no right to change. Even in Israel, we have no say in the type of posters that the advertisement they put up, and all sorts of entertainment, which is all against the Torah, which is immoral, which is kfira. Their music is blasphemy and heresy, and everything, all the concepts they make fun of. You know, I mean, they make literally a big joke of the Torah, of everything, of the religion, and we have no say in it. Okay, if we cannot improve yet and change yet the world outside, but at least our little world, our homes, and ourselves, to protect ourselves and to protect our homes, to be able to relate in the Jewish way to everything, to appreciate all that we relate to according to its real spiritual ultimate aim and purpose, and not to look at things merely at their physical value. We can see this, for example, another example of understanding how really everything depends not on the action done or the way it's done, but on the thought behind it. For example, the Malbim writes, you could have three weddings are taking place, maybe in the same hall, at the same time. Maybe the same rabbi is going to make the Sheva Brachot at this chuppah, and at this chuppah, and at this chuppah. You have three ketubot, you have the families, everything. Three parties. What's the difference? So he says, it depends. One couple, the Hatan thinks he's going into the chuppah, he thinks, I'm marrying Mr. So-and-so's daughter. He's a big businessman. That means I'm going to be in the business. So really, what is he doing? Yeah, they say Sheva Berachot. They have the wine, the ketubah, everything. The color is dressed in white. Beautiful. Everything is wonderful. But really, what's being cut here is a business deal. He did it through marriage. But in his mind, it's a business deal. Or you could have another Hatan. He looked for a very beautiful girl. His whole outlook towards marriage is just to fulfill his desires. So that's what he has. So you have the Sheva Berachot, you have the rabbi, everything. But the ultimate conception of this wedding is what he has in his mind. Whereas someone else, the righteous person, the Hacham, goes into a wedding thinking he's chosen a wife from a good family. He's checked out that she has good characteristics, good hashkafot, her understanding of her outlook in life and towards what she wants and how she wants a husband and children to be and what sort of a home she wants to build. And he goes into marriage looking at these points, which are the fine and the true and the correct points, disregarding maybe other points which are less important. He makes the main point the spiritual side of a marriage. This is a real marriage. So you can see here quite clearly that the approach of a person towards any particular situation changes the whole very essence of that situation. That if you could think here you have three weddings, but in fact one is a business deal, one is an orgy, and one is a wedding. Although they are all similar and all equal. So we have to understand and we have to learn from this week's parasha and from Hanukkah. We have to learn. It's true, I'm speaking on a high level. I understand that these are difficult concepts. But at least we should be aware of the dangers, and we should be aware of the tremendous reward. We cannot imagine what the reward is. Women who will take upon themselves to relate to this concept of spirituality, and will think, when they see anything, when they come in contact with anything, they think, how is the Jewish way concerning this? How is the way of the Torah? How does the Torah regard this situation? How am I supposed to really understand this? Everything has pros and cons. You could say, going on a holiday. Alright? So there's a way to go on a holiday. You have to make sure, first of all, you have to know why you go on a holiday. You go on a holiday because you need some rest. You need to have time. Sometimes the husband is too busy. So he needs time for his wife, for his children. So it's healthy for the family that they have time together without the pressures of business and everyday life. So it's good. Okay, then you have to go on a holiday. You have to make sure you're going to go where there's going to be kosher food. And you can get the right, you know, everything should be as it should be. Beyond the kosher food, you have to make sure that what you see is kosher and where you're going is kosher and what, you know, people don't realize. They don't realize. Today, almost everyone is going to make sure you go to the right grocery where they have everything kosher with the Beit Din and everything is signed by the rabbis and kosher. What about the books we read? And what about the, I don't want to mention, but God forbid, the television, or the videos which are being looked at, or the cinemas which are being seen, which are really, we cannot understand what, you know, how evil these things are. Is there any heksher? Does that have an heksher? Is there a difference what you put in your mouth, or what's entering your eye, or what's going into your, through your ears? I mean, it's all the same. It's either good or bad. It's either destroying or building. It's either contaminating or purifying. This is what we have to understand. There's nothing in the middle. Nothing in the middle. You're either going up or down. There's nothing parve. There's nothing in the middle. If you're going up, you're going up. You stop going up, you're coming down. And that's how we should start relating to our lives and taking it very seriously and protecting ourselves. So that people have become so sensitive and so educated in medication and to know that dietary laws and this is healthy and this is not healthy and this is this could be harmful for that and this could be harmful for that and little bit of this and little bit of that and everything. But these same laws, we have to now take it as Jewish people to another level and think about all the other forms of diet, what we absorb through our eyes, through our nose and through our ears. To make sure that whatever enters our bodies and what is entering and impressing our souls and our minds should be only holy things and good things. Maybe we're going to give ourselves a chance of really being able to serve Hashem. Maybe. It's difficult enough as it is. But when we're so connected up with the non-Jewish world and the non-Jewish concepts about everything, that they rule over us and our minds and our bodies in such a way almost that we have no control of it, that it's so important for us to be able to start relating to everything according to the Jewish way, according to the halakha, according to the concepts of Judaism. I know as women how important it is for women to be good looking, to be dressed nicely and everything. But we have to understand that it has to be according to the way of the Torah. It has to be. The Torah is going to tell us what's mutar and what isn't mutar, and that is beautiful. We have to come to realize that tzniut is beauty, that modesty is beauty. It's not as the world outside is going to tell us that immodesty is beauty. And the wrong way to walk and the wrong way to move and the wrong way to sit and the wrong way to stand and the wrong way to behave, that's the right way. And the way, the Jewish way, which is modesty in movement, in sitting, in standing, in talking, in everything. Because tzniut is not just, you know, people are mistaken to think that tzniut could be okay, so the sleeves have to be long enough, and the dress is long enough, and the stockings thick enough, and everything covered. That's not the end of the whole story of tzniut. Tzniut is how a lady speaks, and how she sits, and how she behaves, and how she acts, and it's very, very minute, and very, very correct, and it's very detailed. It's a whole way of life. And that's why it's really very important. I find myself very fortunate that when I was younger, I was able to be with many of the hachamim from, you know, who at the time were 90 and 100 years old, and sometimes even some of their wives, and to see the modesty that existed, the way a hacham would sit, the way he would talk, the humility, the good manners, the taking other people into account, the whole no roughness, no rudeness, no. Everything is always just to be kind, to be good. So we learn from example. We need to see these type of examples. We need to see the wives of rabbis and good people and Torah students to see how how they behave and their etiquettes and their manners, which is the mannerisms of the Torah. We have our mannerisms. All the goyim have their mannerisms. They're different mannerisms, different customs and different rules of etiquette and good manners in many countries. Each country has its own way, but we have our Jewish way. And we have to be aware and see and to tune into the Jewish way and to see the beauty in our way, not to feel that we're lacking. We don't lack anything. It's all a big bluff. Everything that the whole secular world and the non-Jewish world has blown up, nothing into everything, and the whole world runs after it as if it's the most proved concept that you cannot even discuss. If you'd ask the average people, all the scientists have already refuted completely the concept of evolution, that their grandfathers were apes. But most people believe in it. Why? It's very convenient for them. It's nice to feel grandpa was an ape and I'm a human being, you know. So I don't feel much obligated. I'm good in that in itself, that I'm a human being. Whereas if we know where we're coming from and who our grandparents were and how great the previous generations were, and we come down and we realize that we are now carrying on their way, and we have our way, we have our customs, we have our Shulchan Aruch, we have our Torah, we have all. Let the world see us as a holy nation. Let the world see us an example of modesty, of goodness, of good manners, of hesed, of all the wonderful things which the Jewish religion demands of us and teaches us to do. This is going to make us really Am Segula, a nation which is treasured by Hashem, loved by Hashem. And this is the deep, deep lesson that we have to learn from these weeks, Parashiyot, and especially from Hanukkah coming up, to be able to relate to every single thing according to its spiritual boundaries and its spiritual value, and to see the spirit behind it, and not to be limited in seeing everything through non-Jewish eyes and non-Jewish concepts, where everything is just material without any spirituality.